As the commander and pilot of Starfire 1, Jabhat Nafarazzi knew it was his task to get the space plane safely in the air for the 8,000-mile-plus flight from eastern Siberia down the Sea of Okhotsk and across the Pacific. That meant putting in the rest of the access codes for all the primary and secondary avionics software. He had just fired up the engines and switched the rotating hand controller to primary manual so he could roll them out of the hangar and onto the runway. The laptop's modem attached to the feeder system next to the radar altimeter on the upper left of the red-lighted instrument control panel. Just about everything as far as the instrument panel was backward, or at least slightly altered compared to the American space shuttle. He had learned that during 4 years of special training for this operation. He finished tapping in the sequence of number-letter encryption. Too late now, it occurred to him he should have closed and sealed the hatch. Only up to then, he couldn't be sure which, if any, of his crew was in or out of the craft and how close their engagement with the enemy. But he knew he had to do something about the threat. Then, the idea flared to mind. It would be a counterattack, simply to bring them under control. But he preferred to kill them outright. If they breached the mid-deck, any suicidal stand was the worst of all possible scenarios, and martyrdom was the least ambition for any of them. A trophy, better yet a human shield or two, might also solidify any unforeseen stalling tactic in the event a crisis arose during the flight. He had already seen the two black-clad shooters in action. Evidence of their initial brutal success was strewed around the hangar, and it was all he could do to concentrate, not look back out the flight deck's window. His payload specialist was safe and secure in the weapons bay and arming the missiles, but he needed a status report. He worked at an even more frenzied pace as he banged in the last sequence of numbers and letters that would lock in altitude and speed for every critical group of miles, linking them with the GPS software. Once that was done, there would be no way to override the program, short of shooting the flight deck to ruins. Nafarazzi smiled. Access granted flashed in the upper right-hand corner of his laptop. Nafarazzi hit enter. Check. Starfire's navigational avionics were locked in for the full journey now. Nafarazzi grabbed the TAC radio and hit the button.
Hammond, report!
He jumped out of his seat and tore down the zipper to his gear bag, his AKM assault rifle within a quick, easy grab.
The spears of God are armed. Praise be to God.
Nafarazzi gritted his teeth. He had no patience at that time for such vainglorious nonsense.
Two armed intruders have climbed the ramp.
Yes, we hear the shooting.
Nafarazzi grabbed a small steel canister from his bag.
Throw down your weapons! If you know what is on board this crypt, then you know I can activate all four of these missiles from here!
As McCarter stepped over the second body sprawled inside the crew hatch and aimed his AK-47 up the access ladder, he signaled Hawkins to lock them in. McCarter stared up the ladder, then took in the mid-deck, listening for any sound of movement. He strongly suspected there was one, maybe more, fanatics either hunkered down in the weapons bay or en route through the tunnel access. As for his immediate problem, the invisible threat was close. The ex-SAS commando could feel him, just above, a few feet out of sight.
Then you lose too.
So be it!
This shuttle doesn't leave the hangar. I'm prepared to give up my life to keep that from happening.
Then you are a fool!
McCarter indicated that Hawkins watched the mid-deck and airlock. It was now or never, a straight hard haul up the access ladder, spraying auto-fire the whole way. With luck, his armor would take any and all hits, but he could not, would not, let 20 megatons of suicidal Armageddon leave the ground. If he had to sacrifice his own life and the life of his friend and teammate to avoid a nuclear holocaust that would murder millions, so be it. He grabbed a rung, his finger began taking up slack on the AK's trigger when the object plunged through the hole, spewing out thick clouds of smoke. Gary Manning could see they were too little too late. By the time they surfaced in the elevator, not only were the Russian turncoats executing the work detail with long raking bursts of autofire near the closest east end hangar, but the shuttle was already taxiing onto the runway. Manning fell in with the fighting force and charged on in a skirmish line, the big Canadian flanked by James and Enciso, with Rushdie and Izars on their right wing. There was no chance, short of Enciso blasting the shuttle off the runway with the steamroller, to stop the flying thermonuclear bomb. The space plane rapidly gathered momentum for takeoff as it rolled harder and faster and swept past their position. Any fading hope of shooting out the tires was gone in seconds flat as the craft tore off down the runway into the misty white light. Since they couldn't reach McCarter and Hawkins, they assumed one of two worst-case scenarios. Their teammates either were lying dead in the hangar, or they were on board the RLV. Cover became the next and most immediate concern. There was none. It was flat open ground to the hangar's east wall, maybe 60 yards and counting down, and the snow was about 5 to 7 inches deep. They wore black suits, and the backdrop was pure white. Return fire was minimal at first, since the executioners were torn between chasing down several runners and shell-shocked by the sight of their fellows getting smashed and launched to broken ragdolls. Rushdie and his czars ran on, spreading out, angling for the agreed-upon charge for the back of the hangar. Rushdie wanted a prisoner or two. If that happened, so much the better. But Manning had more pressing matters to attend to. Maybe 8 or 9 survivors began to flee for the relative safety of the hangar as a military-style VIP jet rolled through the opening. Manning could see that Mop-Up was pretty much all that was left. The big Canadian was almost afraid to look, but he stood, and in time to watch the space plane lift off, vanishing altogether in the white shroud.
Now what?
I will take it then that the good Major General is either a prisoner or he is no longer among the living.
Turn the craft around and bring it back to base, or you'll be shot down.
Grenade?
He was alive. Sleeping gas, or whatever the concoction that had knocked him out cold in seconds flat. And that was all David McCarter needed to know. He cracked his eyes open, stifled the groan as harsh but dark sunlight speared through the windshield. As he stared out at the vast sea of billowing white clouds, he flexed his hands. They were free. Why? And why was he even still alive? What about Hawkins? His limbs felt like cement blocks, but adrenaline and ice-cold fear of the unknown quickly cleared away the cobwebs and drove the sludge out of his eyes. He found himself strapped into the right seat. He was minus weapons, combat vest, harness. But he felt the cold steel handle of his knife on the underside of his right forearm as he rolled the limb on the armrest. It was just inside the sleeve, sheathed right above the wrist. How they had overlooked it was beyond him.
Ah, as we speak, one of your two comrades is now waking up.
Mac, are you TJ all right?
McCarter was about to answer Manning when his nemesis swiveled some in his commander's chair and lifted the Makarov pistol.
They're just fine for the present. But never mind about them.
McCarter turned his head to Hawkins, who was coming alive in the mission specialist's seat.
Say, mate, can you hear me?
Hawkins nodded and glanced at the AKM assault rifle aimed from the payload specialist's seat.
How's that right arm holding up where you had that steel plate put in last year?
Silence!
Well, good to go, but that's the least of it. Or am I stating the obvious?
Hawkins' captor jabbed him in the ribs with the assault rifle.
Talk again, and I will shoot you!
McCarter watched as the smile spread over the swarthy face next to him. The man was lean and wiry, hair closely cropped with no beard. The ex-SAS commando suspected that the non-Muslim appearance, as far as facial hair went, had become a standard ruse by Islamic fanatics these days for infiltrating and maintaining sleeper cells. He had 1,001 questions, but knew it was best to stay silent for the time being and wait for the right moment. That one split second where his potential mark dropped his guard. He decided to let the fanatic gloat, enjoy whatever triumph he believed he was about to reap from his commandeering of the RLV.
Whoever you are, let us be clear on the facts of life as I humbly give them to you. One, the radar sensors that shroud this craft can detect any bogey up to 15 miles. Two, should a missile be launched at us, those sensors will transmit a signal that is tied into the computer systems of the payload that, as you may or may not know, was specially designed by the ESA in collusion with your country. That would be Russia, since I believe you used American commandos to help attack the base. In the event of a doomsday scenario as drawn by Moscow regarding this craft. Three, The missiles are coated in black ferrite paint, among other anti-radar tracking and electronic countermeasure components. In other words, they are virtually invisible to radar. Moreover, they are rocket-driven warheads, which makes them far faster than any jet-propelled missile.
All of that may be true, but you would commit suicide. The system was not yet completed to launch those missiles on their own, if the airspace monitored by its radar was breached. All that would happen is you blow yourselves up in mid-air. Your mission a failure.
Perhaps. But you do not actually know that for certain, nor do you know what I know. And being that I am aware of how much Americans value the lives of their own, even two such failures as commandos such as I have here, I'm betting you will not attempt such an attack. Further, I suspect that since you are acting in some capacity in your own country's invested interest in this RLV, you cling to the false hope you may get the craft back in one working piece. Long live Islam! God is great!
And with that, he snapped off the transmission. McCarter watched for a moment as the fanatic commander worked the keyboard of his laptop. A radar screen flashed on, along with numbers scrolling in the top right-hand corner. The radar part of the monitor looked clear of air traffic. Then the Briton stared out the windshield as they plunged into thick clouds, getting his bearings as best he could. He noted the shafts of light spearing through in multicolored dark-shrouded layers. Flying into, or rather under and past the sun. They had to be somewhere north of the equator, if he judged the foreshadowing of light and mixed shadow correctly, which meant they were heading east, streaking into yesterday once they crossed the international dateline. How long he'd been under was impossible to say. If they were cruising at supersonic speed and streaking over the Pacific, the target, or targets, would either be the Hawaiian Islands or the west coast of the United States. He felt the ball of ice wedge in his twisting guts. Could be that Los Angeles was marked for extinction, or San Diego, or San Francisco. Those were the most likely possibilities. Las Vegas was a short flight across the desert for the last missile. Portland, just up the coast from San Francisco. They were rocket-fueled instead of jet-engine-powered like the standard U.S. cruise missiles, sacrificing range for speed. Then again, if the whole payload was intended as one flying bomb, that meant the fanatics were hell-bent on plowing the RLV straight into the target.
Since you let us live, I assume you're probably itching to tell us what you plan to vaporize in your nuclear jihad.
I let you live so that you may bear final witness to the glory of Islam.
No, you let us live because you didn't want us shooting up the ship before you went wheels up.
In a few short hours, gentlemen, four at most, you will see the California coastline. Just look for the big sign that says Hollywood.
McCarter felt his heart skip a beat. 20 megatons was more than enough to incinerate all of Southern California. Good news. He could count on their teammates back at Zenith to put in the SOS to the farm. Then what? Rognola would alert the White House. The Pacific Ocean was well-traveled and monitored by a fleet of American subs and carrier groups. Hawaii alone served as the midway point and major ring of surveillance and counter-surveillance. The lives of two men were less than nothing when weighed against the mass murder of countless millions. They would be blown out of the sky, no matter what the fanatic or Rushdie claimed in their exchange of saber-rattling.
It's fitting, don't you think?
McCarter looked at Nafarazzi, noticing how he released the web straps by depressing the steel catch around his sternum.
What's that?
That Los Angeles, your Hollywood, what is modern Babylon, a more fitting Sodom and Gomorrah, is due to be vaporized in what I consider nothing less than the wrath of God in one giant fiery breath from heaven that will cleanse the world of filth and immorality that you infidels attempt to contaminate and undermine the rest of the world with.
Which told McCarter, one payload, one city, and that was no comfort at all. The Briton needed an opening, and quick. Maybe this sack of living evil beside him could be blinded, if only for an instant, by his own arrogance. The pistol swung a few inches toward the Phoenix Force leader's face.
Hammond, bring up parachutes. Disable those we won't be needing.
So you never intended to go down with this ship?
Why? That particular foolishness is better suited for the lowliest soldier. At any rate,
The autopilot will take the craft to within 1 square mile of downtown Los Angeles. The very fact that no bogeys have yet shown up on my screen tells me that by the time our presence is known, it will be way too late. Even if the ship is blown out of the sky within 25 miles of the coast, by then it will be so low, the blast alone could very well kill hundreds of thousands. Of course, you may be aware of fallout and the like. The prevailing winds blowing in from the Pacific will do just fine as far as my own plan B goes. Naturally, where the Ground Zero is downtown Los Angeles or a mere few miles out to sea, there will be mass panic, nothing short of anarchy. Riots, looting, murder in the streets as the infidels become unhinged. Martial law, then complete meltdown of law and order. Perhaps even the White House will be overthrown by the panicked and terrified masses of armed savages in the streets and those who feel compelled to storm the gates, if only out of blind rage and horror. Yes, I can even now see it all clearly. The president, his family perhaps dragged out onto the White House lawns and executed in the most shameful and horrifying of ways. Oh, and perhaps even filmed by the media, who is always in search of a sensational story. Oh, do relax and enjoy the rest of your flight.
Sounds like you knew a whole lot more than you let on.
They were back in the abattoir of Mission Control. Maybe a dozen of the surviving traitors had thrown down their weapons and surrendered, and were currently under guard and interrogation by a few czars up top. Only the battle to secure the grounds now seemed a minor skirmish with sticks when Manning considered the nightmare they were all faced with.
What's this about the RLV doomsday scenario? What haven't you told us, comrade?
I think my teammate speaks for us all when he says this is the final warning for you to come clean.
Rushdie hardened his features, his jaw clenched as he stared down the bank of blank security monitors.
The fuel that powers the craft is of a highly classified nature. The Russian mafia, in collusion with certain business partners and politicians in Moscow, managed to stake claim to certain fields here in Siberia, where this reserve was discovered. Aerodynamically speaking, it should not even fly at supersonic speeds, but it is made of, again, a highly classified alloy that only makes it appear to the naked eye as a huge lumbering space bus. Be that as it may, in the event of World War III, my country, working with the ESA, or rather its conspirators, mind you, intended to build and place as many of these RLVs into low Earth orbit as possible. From Earth stations, they could be programmed to become flying thermonuclear bombs, virtually undetectable by ground radar and other satellites. Even if they were shot down coming through the atmosphere, there would be enough.
We have the picture. What we need now is to reach our people. Rafe, please tell me you still have the buzz box.
Enciso reached into a pouch on his combat vest and produced the small black box. The instrument was a state-of-the-art scrambler and signal relay device that would create ghost transmissions from an unsecured line. Manning turned on Rushdie.
We need a radio, satlink, anything to reach our people like 5 minutes ago. You can fill us in on anything you've forgotten or neglected to tell us while we dial up the SOS.
That would make it, what, almost 3 hours, give or take, since Phoenix said they took off. Hell. And with Rushdie claiming a Russian radar and tracking station near the Okhotsk coast, told him it was clocked at Mach 3 and heading southeast, and with the bearings we got...
Neither the mission controller nor the cyber team leader spoke as Brognola let the statement trail off. Kurtzman brought up the digital map on the wall monitor. His laptop modem was hooked to the feeder mount at the base of the wall. At the same time, Takedo was shooting up to the second intel from the computer room. Oddly enough, despite the fact the oxygen seemed sucked out of the war room and the walls had all but closed in, Brognola felt a steely calm. As Kurtzman framed the area in question, from eastern Siberia and which encompassed the entire Pacific Ocean to the west coast from Seattle to San Diego, Brognola knew he was seconds away from grabbing up the red phone and informing the President of the United States a thermonuclear bomb was God only knew how long from erupting on American soil.
Pal, at this point it's all very bad news. The ship being marked as American is a cheap ruse, but it may buy them just enough time, and with stealth technology that may even be years ahead of what we have now.
Kurtzman hit a few keys, and five red lines with numbers over each and running from about the 55th parallel to the 33rd appeared on the monitor.
Those are estimated impact times and targets. Seattle, Portland, San Francisco.
L.A. and San Diego. What about Hawaii?
They've either hit it already or they've sailed past. If past the islands, they'd be far north and have another target or targets in mind.
Kurtzman tapped a few more keys and outlined a red area from Vancouver to San Diego and a chunk of the Pacific Ocean off the coast.
Mainland U.S.
Another problem is that there's no way we can hack into any sat and park it, or even steer it over the Pacific or find one.
I understand all that, Bear. What you're showing us is pretty much an educated guess of its flight path, with projected distance, altitude, time to impact, based on true ground speed.
Hal, we'll assume they have so far remained undetected. You're going to have to call the President.
The best we can do with what little intel we have is to track its path on educated guesses. Basically, we're out of touch, totally blind at the moment. Under the circumstances, we have to assume the worst of worst-case scenarios and make the preemptive call.
The big Fed felt his head nod ever so slightly. There was no choice. Fighter jets or a missile launched from a submarine or a battleship. But either way, the RLV had to be blown out of the sky. ASAP. And, in the process, they would lose both McCarter and Hawkins. It was no consolation that Brognola knew they all understood and accepted the ultimate sacrifice. No questions, no pleas, no stalling for more time. Sudden death was part of the job description, but Brognola always lived in what was a tenuous hope that the day would never come where they would lose another of their field operatives. It was something of a hollow hope, considering the world in which they lived and fought, and how the stakes were so high and so volatile.
Hal, unless we hear from David or TJ, and even then...
Brognola nodded and reached for the red phone. The RLV's terrorist commander was grinning, bobbing his head, and McCarter knew it was now or never. He was hitting the delete key, rising from his chair, when the ex-SAS commando depressed the release catch, hoping to God they hadn't jammed it somehow. He was free. Hawkins was a blur of human lightning in the corner of his eye, but McCarter was locked in raging tempest himself, seizing his own initiative, sliding the blade out of its sheath, and plunging the razor-sharp steel into the fanatic's throat. McCarter was about to step over the convulsing body to help his teammate when he found he needn't bother. Another spreading pool of blood was all the grim testament the Briton needed that the ex-Ranger had delivered a near-decapitating strike himself. They were hardened professionals, used to dispensing violent death, but both of them held their ground for a moment, stunned by their own lightning kills that it was over in less time than it took to blink, keeping the blades poised as if fearing the dead would suddenly rise. McCarter strode the few steps with Hawkins to the pile of gear and parachute packs stacked near the bank of payload controls. Hawkins held up two handfuls of shredded canopy, but showed the Phoenix Force leader the other packs were stuffed and ready. Another nylon bag contained helmets, oxygen bottles, and gloves. Whether they would have enough time to check and repack the chutes and slip into the enemy's pressure suits for a jump into sub-zero airless altitude was anybody's guess. McCarter turned to charge back for the main instrument panel, moving to radio his teammates.
David.
The terrorists, for whatever reasons, had decided not to throw their sat link overboard. McCarter hesitated, looked back out at the windshield as they shot from the cloud bank. Suddenly, he felt the aircraft dip, the motion nearly rocking him off his heels. That was no turbulence. They were losing altitude, fast. Another shudder, and he knew the speed was being cut back, and drastically.
David, if you're thinking about looking at those missiles and maybe trying to disarm them...
He was, in fact. Then he realized any second an American fighter jet or a Tomahawk missile could be launched from a sub. And if it was true about the payload being touched off, if the RLV's airspace was breached, they would never know what hit them.
Get into one of those pressure suits, TJ, and go blow the hatch. I'll phone home.
Hey, look at this!
Hawkins held up a flare gun. Rescue was hardly guaranteed, not by a long shot, but McCarter felt the tight smile tug at the corner of his mouth.
I understand, Mr. President.
Well?
The President's gone to the Situation Room. They had a suspicion, once it breached airspace of a remote U.S. naval base on an island northwest of Hawaii that's not even found on any world map. But the man told me that I only confirmed it.
They said nothing, but Brognola sensed they knew the bottom line.
All hands, including British warships stationed in the Pacific, I understand, have been alerted. 20 minutes. That's the proposed time frame he said was needed to try to pinpoint a reasonable window of collateral damage as far as shipping lanes, air traffic, while at the same time, every control tower on the West Coast is being handed a presidential directive to reroute, bring back, keep grounded, well...
But they were jumping just as soon as David signed off.
Brognola recalled the grim math Kurtzman had just done minutes ago, according to FEMA and NSA calculations of nuclear blasts. 1 megaton, 1 city. That's what the brains in the U.S. intelligence think tanks called it. A 1 megaton blast, a direct hit in the average downtown American city, would vomit out a crater 200 feet deep, 1,000 feet across. Within that first circle, anywhere from 100,000 up to 500,000 people would be vaporized instantly, depending on population density, the lay of the urban landscape, while legions of other living creatures would be set ablaze. Buildings would literally melt, assuming a few were even still partially standing, or would be ignited into towering torches. 2 miles beyond ground zero and the blast waves were still going strong. 150-mile-per-hour winds that were superheated, like the core of the sun. Now, with 20 megatons, simply multiply those numbers.
Hal, what did he say about our people?
Brognola looked at Price.
He said he'd call back as soon as it was done.
McCarter plummeted toward the Pacific Ocean, and for the life of him, he couldn't determine how high up he was or which direction he was tumbling. The world rushed up at him in a maze of flying shadows and broken light, with the rapidly growing velvet expanse of a glassy surface, and where only the smallest detail of white caps betrayed the swells. And he knew the Big Bang was coming. He twisted, one gloved hand reaching for the ripcord, his head swiveling in its oxygenated helmet. There was no sign of Hawkins, but the ex-Ranger had jumped first. He had been a split second behind, out the hatch. It was a miracle by itself they had survived hitting the air and being blasted at speeds that were close to Mach. They had set their chronometers, roughly gauging descent and how far they would drift apart. McCarter checked his watch. One last look at the blackness below, and he couldn't be sure if they were at 20,000 or 2,000 feet. But they needed as fast a plunge down as possible before opening the canopies. He kept waiting for the moment, braced for the worst, prepared for the end. There was no sign of the RLV, not that he expected to see it, but he'd been informed that the White House would be alerted and told the terrible truth, which meant every available fighter jet scrambled, every nuke sub and carrier scouring every square mile. He was surprised the sky, dark to the east, had not yet lit up. The clock struck. McCarter tugged on the steel pin. He was waiting for what seemed like an eternity for the familiar bone-jarring jolt that told him the canopy had opened when there was no mistaking the sudden burst of dazzling white light to the distant east. McCarter and Hawkins were dying. The swells had been bouncing them around for close to 6 hours now, according to his last watch check. Even with the pressure suits acting as another thermal layer over their form-fitting black suits, the water this far north of the equator was bitter cold. The sun became another enemy. Not only did it further sap what little energy they had in reserve, but it nearly sucked out every last drop of life-sustaining water. Dehydration was fast setting in. Death wasn't far behind. But they were still alive, clinging to whatever life they had left. And just when David McCarter didn't think he had any more left to give, the silent warrior spirit urged him to take one more breath, thrust one more scissor kick to keep his head above water, endure one more angry swell rolling over his head or pounding him in the face. There was yet another fear to consider. Sharks would soon be closing in, if they weren't already in the general vicinity. But with the current and the swells, he suspected neither one of them would spot a dorsal fin until it was nearly right in front of their bloodshot eyes. Strange how being eaten alive would seem like the most grotesque of all possible injustices, considering what the two of them had lived through. No planes, no aircraft of any kind, no birds. Nothing. There had still been some blood on his blade when he used it to slice himself out of the harness. He had resheathed it in a hurry without wiping it off before jumping. Understandable, but under the circumstances, suddenly unforgivable. And mighty damn foolish.
Sharks!
There were something like 30 species out here, and how many were man-eating he couldn't say as he thought he spotted a dorsal fin. It was. And it was a big one. From where he floated, it looked the size of a surfboard, knifing through the swells to the north and headed their way. Countless islands were scattered all over the Pacific, many of them breeding grounds for seals and sea lions. Wherever there were those choice fat seal banquets, there would be white sharks.
David!
It was a miracle they were still close enough to shout and hear each other, a miracle they were still alive. He'd hit the water like a falling asteroid, then gone under like a sinking stone before slicing himself free with his blade. He could be sure Hawkins was counting his blessings too, at least for the moment.
I'm here.
We have company.
I hope you mean by that a search and rescue chopper.
I have one flare left. I'm thinking...
Try and save it. But if that's what I think I just saw, use it. Go for the eyes.
Something danced into his field of vision. The ocean, like the desert, could create its own illusions, fooling trusting eyes that were already battered by the elements.
David!
McCarter squinted, bobbed up, rolled down, then was slammed full in the face by another higher swell. His stomach knotted as he steeled himself for that bone-chilling scream.
David!
McCarter stroked around, looking to the northwest. He grimaced as Hawkins shot the flare into the sky. A smile broke over McCarter's lips. The flare was erupting high overhead in what was to him a sweet umbrella of blinding light. McCarter watched as the sea stallion banked hard, then came soaring their way.
I understand, Mr. President. There was nothing else that could have been done. I understand.
He understood? What exactly did he understand? He understood that a 20-megaton blast hadn't blown anywhere near the West Coast. The airburst had erupted over 200 nautical miles out to sea. He understood that an unsuspecting Los Angeles had been saved. And the Big Fed wished to God he could tell the whole damn bunch out there in California why and who and how. That they should be erecting monuments to two men by the names of David McCarter and Thomas Jackson Hawkins. But he understood this too. As far as saving LA and staving off World War III for another day, the mission was a success. Still, two of the best commandos on the planet were missing, or dead. Brognola was alone in the war room, and he was as alone as he'd felt in a long time. It was all he could do to shut out the screaming madness of anger and grief. He stared at the wall monitor, at the area Kurtzman had flagged, where the space plane's thermonuclear payload had been touched off by a vertically launched missile from a new class of submarine.
Hal.
He realized Barbara Price had just walked in. For a second, as he started to look up, he wondered if she was coming to burden him with yet more ghosts. He wasn't sure what he saw on her face at first, but then reality gradually sank in as he stared at the mission controller's face. Hal Brognola knew that look, and it told the Big Fed all of their people had made it to fight the good fight another day.
Stony Man Starfire is a Graphic Audio production. Copyright 2007, Don Pendleton. Production copyright 2007, The Cutting Corporation. All rights reserved. Performed by James Konacek, Terrence Aselford, Jeff Baker, Christopher Graybill, Richard Rowan, Thomas Penny, Nanette Savard, Ken Jackson, David Coyne, Dylan Lynch, James Lewis, Michael Replogel, and Mort Shelby. Additional red shirts by The Dead Giveaways. Book adapted for graphic audio by Wilson T. Ferrier. Directed by Dan Smith. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Dialogue editing and graphic audio digital effects by Brian Patton and Christian Parent. Additional music by Johann Detweiler, Dan Smith, Brian Patton, Chris Rowan, and Matt Webb. The Stony Man theme was composed by Mark Ashby. If you enjoyed Stony Man, be sure to look for Don Pendleton's Mac Bolan and Ryder Stacey's Doomsday Warrior, available at road stops everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net, where you'll also find samples of all our Action Pump titles, as well as free screensavers, desktops, ringtones, and games. Keep listening for previews of other Graphic Audio titles.
Available now from Graphic Audio. Blood Bond, number one.
Bodine unbuckled his gun belt and laid it on a log. Two wolves did the same. As he was straightening up, Bodine hit him in the mouth with an uppercut that stood two wolves up on his toes. Bodine followed that with a hard, straight left to the belly. Two wolves hit the ground and rolled, coming up fast and with a fistful of sand, which he tossed in Bodine's eyes. With Bodine momentarily blinded by the sand, two wolves busted him in the mouth with a hard fist and then brought a left around that landed solidly against Bodine's jaw. Bodine went down and grabbed two wolves' ankles, spilling him to the sand. The men wrestled for position, and with neither able to get the upper hand, the men fought on their knees in the damp sand until two wolves connected with a hard right to Bodine's jaw, knocking him back. Two wolves jumped at him, and Bodine put up a boot, catching two wolves in the chest and propelling him over his head. Two wolves landing on his belly in the sand. Bodine scrambled to his boots just as two wolves was getting up on his hands and knees and jumped on two wolves' back, riding him back down to the sand, his brother's head in a hammerlock. Two wolves bit down on Bodine's finger. Bodine lost his grip on two wolves' head. Two wolves broke free and grabbed Bodine, throwing him to the ground. Bodine kicked his brother on the knee, and the two wolves staggered back as Bodine lurched to his feet. The two went at it, standing toe-to-toe and slugging it out. On a hill above the river, a band of Sioux sat their ponies and watched the men fight. They had been out hunting for food and were pleased with their efforts, so they let the naked gun hands ride on, thinking it a funny sight. Wolf going away shook his head in disgust.
What do you suppose they were fighting about?
I think Two Wolves has gone crazy since Medicine Horse ordered him to adopt the white man's ways. They're a very strange people, you know.
You son of a bitch! Jealous bastard!
Bull Bear looked at the others in the band.
Jealous? Of what? What does one brother have that the other wants?
Bodine got up and knocked two wolves down, then stepped back, catching his breath. Standing alone, tipped his head, watching.
They're not really fighting to hurt the other.
I have seen enough.
He heeled his horse forward, the others following. Bodine and two wolves were flailing away at each other when the hunting party rode up.
Stop this! I will have no more of this!
We started it!
Silence! Your father's brother took my sister for a wife, so you will obey me. Silly young men. Is there not enough blood being spilled over this land without you two adding to it?
Bodine pointed a finger at two wolves.
He's a liar!
Be quiet! You have shared my lodge and my fire and eaten my food. Now, I ask only that you respect my right to speak.
Bodine and Two Wolves sat on the wet sand and glared at each other. Fat Bear dismounted, picked up a stick, and beat both of them on the back, showing them his contempt for their childish behavior. With that, he jumped back on his horse and rode off, the others following him. As they passed, they refused to look at Bodine or Two Wolves, another sign of contempt. Bodine got to his feet and felt his stinging back.
Oh, that old man still swings a pretty mean stick.
You deserved it.
Bodine looked at him, smiled, and then flattened him with a right to the mouth. They had fought all over the bank, churning up the sand, fought out in the river and back, each one doing their best to drown the other, and were on the bank, still flailing weakly away at each other, when an army patrol led by Sergeant McGuire rode up.
All right, men, break them up!
Bodine and Two Wolves collapsed from exhaustion on the sands. They could barely move. McGuire dismounted and squatted down beside them.
Yeah. I don't suppose one of you would like to tell me what this is all about.
It's personal.
I thought it might be. You intend to lie here by the river all day?
The sun does feel nice.
How the hell did you get those marks on your backs, boys?
Fat Bear came by and was disgusted with us. He beat us for our disgraceful behavior.
The Sioux War Chief came by and he beat you both. Are you two going to start fighting when we leave?
No.
Private, drag them over there by their horses. Lone Dog's up in Montana, so they'll be all right. Let's go. We've got to make the Fork of the Clear and the Crazy Woman before dark. Fat Bear came by and beat you. I'd have given a bottle of whiskey to see that.
If you can't find that hot graphic audio title you're looking for, just head to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD or MP3 disc format. Or, the fastest and cheapest way, download that puppy and play it on any of the many devices that'll play Windows Media. And if you're on the road or just a total computer feeb, snatch up the phone and call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220 or www.graphicaudio.net.